22-0432, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Early Romero Blevins Appellant.
The only change with being back at the Judicial Center is you can choose which podium you wish to speak from. If you wish to speak in the middle, it is a riser. The desk will go up and down. If you choose to simply speak at the podium next to you, that's a fixed item. You're not going to be able to move it. Please indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of when you introduce yourself for our record-keeping purposes. And appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
May it please the court, I am Sarah Martin, I represent...
I'm going to interrupt a minute. Do we have our microphones on?
Yes, it's showing us.
Okay, all right. I don't have any lights up here, which is different.
The lights for the judge's microphones should not be on.
I would just also note that there's no timer.
That's what I'm getting at.
I apologize.
That's okay. Now, everything is fine. I'll remember this day for quite a while. Okay, all right, go ahead, Ms. Martin.
I'll start over again. May it please the court, I'm Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Early Blevins. A group of three people threatened Mr. Blevins' life at a downtown light rail station. Mr. Blevins responded by brandishing a machete, waving it at the three people, and yelling at them. The trial court found that Mr. Blevins was not the aggressor in this matter and that he reasonably feared for his life. The court rejected his self-defense claim, however, because it believed he failed to retreat despite having the opportunity. Mr. Blevins asks this court to reverse for two reasons. First, under the circumstances of this case, he did not have a duty to retreat before resorting to non-physical force. And second, even if he did have a duty to retreat, under the circumstances of this case, there was no safe avenue of retreat where the only escape route was behind him and he could not safely turn his back to the three aggressors.
You know, from my perspective, Ms. Martin, this case is interesting because of all of the video that we certainly watched also. And I always go back to thinking, in my trial court days, the judge has discretion. They watch the video, they listen to the testimony. But here we are as an appellate body, and we are re-watching videotape that the trial court judge also saw. Mm-hmm. And then the decision was made that he had a place to safely retreat based on the footage. So I'm just wondering, do we look at that differently because we can also watch the same video?
I think, Your Honor, the determination that he could safely retreat, that is a conclusion of law that is based upon the evidence presented. This court can review the same evidence and come to a different conclusion.
So we could conclude, it's not a factual question whether it was safe?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if we didn't have a videotape, but we had sort of testimony about describing what it looked like and et cetera, we in a district court decided there was a safe avenue of retreat, we could read that testimony and decide, no, it seems like it wouldn't have been safe to do X, Y, and Z.
That's correct. The trial court would make findings of fact based upon the testimony regarding, for example, what possible barriers were, how many people were around, whatever other conditions existed. And then the trial court would make a legal conclusion that there was an ability to safely retreat.
So the safeliness of it is not a factual question, it's a legal question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. It feels so factual to me. It feels less legal and more factual. I don't know why that is, but it just sort of does.
And I urge you to have this discussion with us because, you know, we have body cams. We didn't have that before. I mean, this is a whole different emerging area in terms of what we're looking at, what we're watching, and what our role is as an appellate judges in terms of what the trial court or the jury, for that matter, saw or heard.
Yeah, and I understand that, Your Honor. And I think that the distinction is whether they're making a strictly factual determination. Factual determinations would be something like the conditions. For example, if the trial court had made a factual determination that there was a solid barrier on one side, for example, that would be a factual determination. You review that to determine whether it's clearly erroneous. I think the fact that you have more evidence or more types of evidence available makes your job perhaps a little bit easier in determining whether or not the court's decision was correct, the factual or the legal determination was correct. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, in cases maybe 10 or 15 years ago when there wasn't so much camera evidence, you would rely solely on witnesses describing something rather than you physically seeing something. But I guess that would be the same thing if there was a photograph 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So if we get to the you're making a legal argument. We'll get to your second legal argument, which is that in these circumstances where it's non-physical force that's used, there should be no duty to retreat. And so you cite Glowacki for the principle that that self-defense still requires a duty to retreat when in non-deadly force cases, right, in Minnesota?
That's correct.
Okay. And so what I understand you're saying is, okay, we understand that non-deadly force cases, there's a duty to retreat, but we want to slice off part of that and say when the non-deadly force is actually non-physical force, like brandishing a weapon, that in that case, we should slice that out from the rule and say that no duty to retreat applies then. Explain to me why we would do that.
The reason for that is there's a first start with the fact that the duty to retreat is not included in the statute. The duty to retreat has developed over the years through case law, and the policy behind that is a desire to prevent unnecessary bodily harm or death. But we don't have that interest when the case involves a non-physical threat, when it involves a verbal threat or a demonstrative threat, as we had in this case. So the question is whether the overall question
why wouldn't there still, the more one amps up, you know, you threaten me with fists, I respond with a knife, the other person pulls out a gun. I mean, why doesn't that escalation of you know, non-physical but threats of force lead more to the possibility and the risk of bodily injury and harm than just retreating if you can?
I would agree that that is a possibility, but that's a different interest than has been announced in the cases dealing with self-defense and the duty to retreat. The basis for the duty to retreat has, it started out with a duty to retreat before using deadly force, and it evolved into a duty to retreat before using force that would result in bodily harm. I would agree that there is a possibility that using a verbal threat or demonstrative threat could escalate a situation and could result in harm. However, the point is, at what point do we want to limit someone's ability to defend themselves? And under this reasonableness test that looks at all of the circumstances, using a threat to scare someone off, whether it's verbal or demonstrative, is reasonable under the circumstances of this case. And I'm not suggesting that it is always going to be reasonable to brandish a weapon or to make a verbal threat in response to something. It still needs to follow the other portions of the self-defense test, which is they must reasonably fear bodily harm, and they may only use the level of force necessary to alleviate that harm or to avoid that harm.
And when you cited to cases in other jurisdictions in your brief, mm-hmm. I looked at those. Were those cases that in states that follow sort of our Glowacki rule? Or were they seem to deal more with the difference between deadly and non-deadly force, et cetera, not necessarily let's take non-deadly force where there's a duty to retreat and carve out non-physical force.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
The cases do. The point that I was trying to make with those cases is that there are jurisdictions that distinguish between
use of physical force and the threat of use of physical force. And places that would, or under circumstances where physical force or deadly force is not warranted, the person is still permitted to brandish a weapon or make a threat of deadly force.
And then I know you distinguished, there were two cases talked about that were assault fear cases where the duty to retreat is discussed. And one of them, at least, it seems, it's the one with initials, the juvenile case, W-A-H maybe.
Correct, yes.
It seemed part of the holding in that case, that it was one of the reasons. It's a precedential decision. Why could we decide differently here?
I would agree that in both SOIN and Welfare of WAH that the court mentioned the duty to retreat, but it does not appear that in those cases the court was presented with this question, and I could find no case where the defendant was not the aggressor, the defendant was threatened with bodily harm or death, and the defendant reasonably feared for their safety. So I think that those cases are very distinguishable from the circumstances of this case.
And why do those circumstances, which relate to the other factors, have to do with whether duty to retreat is a factor or not in an assault fear case?
Again, Your Honor, both of those cases, and as I said in my brief, they both mentioned duty to retreat. Mm-hmm. I just don't believe that the court was actually presented with this issue, so did not rule on this issue.
You don't think it was part of the holding of the case that the person failed to retreat when the defendant failed to retreat when there was an opportunity, that was not part of the holding of the case?
I believe that it was the holding overall was that the defendant in those cases acted unreasonably under the circumstances. And in Soin, for example, he wasn't retreating, he was actually pursuing.
Right, that one people. Seems different to me.
Yes.
Yeah.
In WAH, the juvenile, he was attempted trying to break into a car, and he used a knife to threaten the people that pursued and caught him. Those individuals had not made any threats, they were not brandishing weapons. So I think overall, the circumstances showed that they were not behaving reasonably under the circumstances.
Do you think this case has value as a precedential opinion?
I do, Your Honor, because, again, neither this court nor the Supreme Court have addressed a case with circumstances similar to this. Even if this court determines that Mr. Blevins had a duty to retreat, considering all of the circumstances at the time of the incident, there was no reasonably safe avenue for him to retreat. The duty to retreat is part of the reasonableness inquiry. In 1905, in the Gardner decision, the court cautioned against distorting the duty to retreat into an unreasonable duty to retreat. So considering all of the circumstances confronting Mr. Blevins at the time of the incident, the question is, would a reasonable person in his position believe that they had a reasonable way to escape? And the answer is no. In order to retreat in this case, Mr. Blevins would have had to turn his back on the three aggressors, one of whom he knew was armed and had just threatened to slit his throat. This is not a reasonable expectation for someone who had just been threatened by three people, including an armed person. The state argues that there are 10 opportunities for Mr. Blevins to retreat, and he could have fled by train, he could have fled by foot, or by calling the police. I want to point out that this includes opportunities before the incident escalated. Mr. Blevins was not required to retreat from the situation merely because FTT was upset with him for refusing to buy drugs from her. There is no requirement to retreat from a physical or a verbal dispute. The critical time period here is after MBS brandishes the knife and threatens to slit Mr. Blevins' throat. And that's at roughly timestamp 12 minutes and 50 seconds on Exhibit 7. At that point, the train's doors have closed, so getting on the train is not an option. Calling the police is not a legitimate means of defending himself in the moment when he is presented with a person who has brandished a knife and threatened to slit his throat. So the only means of retreat for him is on foot.
There's no train that comes after MBS brandishes the knife?
The train is still there, but the doors are closed. That train leaves, and then Mr. Blevins gets on the next train that comes. During this entire time, from the time that MBS threatens him until the time Mr. Touch attacks him from behind, the aggressors are continuing to engage. They individually walk back and forth, but there is no point that all three of them retreat together until just before Mr. Touch attacks Mr. Blevins. And this is when, as the court found, Mr. Blevins assumed a less aggressive stance. He put his arm down by his side, and the court found him credible when he said at that point he was intending to resheath his weapon. So looking at the video, Mr. Blevins has a very limited avenue of retreat. The fact that he's on the light rail platform does limit his options. He is surrounded on one side by the three aggressors, on another side by the railroad tracks, and another side there's a shelter and there's a railing. The only unobstructed place for him to go is behind him. And a reasonable person in his position would not pause, assess the escape options, or turn his back to the aggressors. Thank you.
And of course, you'll have your 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
We will hear from the state.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. This case regards appellant Mr. Blevins wielding, chopping, and waving a machete at several people at a light rail station in daylight hours in downtown Minneapolis near the U.S. Bank Stadium. This court should affirm because sufficient evidence proved beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant did not act in self-defense, and that is because he had a legal duty to retreat. It was reasonably possible for him to retreat. He did ultimately retreat after nearly severing JT's hand, and because he failed to retreat, his self-defense claim fails. Based on this court's questions so far this morning, I'd like to use my argument time to do two things. One is to emphasize the standard of review in this case, and second, address a few factual clarifications based on counsel's argument this morning. So first, with regard to the standard of review, although this issue as presented by appellant is a sufficiency of the evidence claim, the evidence presented in district court is direct evidence, which means that this court must affirm if the district court could reasonably have concluded that the defendant was proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and the state had also disproven beyond a reasonable doubt at least one element of self-defense, and in this case it was retreat that the district court found that the state did disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. If this were a sufficiency of the evidence claim based on circumstantial evidence, there would be heightened scrutiny, but as it stands, the procedural posture of this case, it is the direct evidence standard of review for sufficiency of the evidence. So this court, therefore, should defer to the district court.
What does that mean with respect to the issue of safe, whether it's safe to retreat?
Yes. I think Your Honor is getting at the original questions posed to opposing counsel about whether this is a factual legal determination. and it is not a factual determination. There is no reweighing required here. And I'll emphasize the
It is not a factual determination.
I'm sorry, it is.
Oh, it is a fact. Okay. That's critical.
I appreciate that. Thank you for letting me clarify. And that is so because of the actual words used in the standard of review here, in the elements of self-defense. It is not regard... safety is not a word included in the duty to retreat analysis. What the duty to retreat legally requires is it reasonably possible for the defendant to retreat? It is not, is it safe enough? Is it safe to this particular defendant subjectively? No, it is an objective inquiry looking at, in this case, the direct evidence, the video surveillance. Can he retreat without, is it reasonably possible for him to retreat?
And so in that case, though, but I suppose your opposing counsel would say, yes, reasonably possible is still a legal question, not a factual question. We don't defer to a fact finder's decision that it is reasonable or not. We look at the evidence to see if it sustains the conclusion that there was a reasonable opportunity.
And it's difficult for me to follow that because of the standard of review in this case. The standard of review is generous to the district court. They had the opportunity to weigh all the evidence and review the direct evidence, the video in this case. And so I follow what Your Honor is saying, but because of the standard of review in this case, that is getting, it's taking too close of a look. We're entering the circumstantial evidence realm of review in this case, and you simply don't need to. You defer to the district court if they had a reasonable basis, the language is if they could have reasonably concluded that the defendant was proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and that includes disproving retreat. Or the disproving the element of the duty to retreat for self-defense in this mm-hmm. case. So because of how layered this analysis is, that should not weigh into this court's opinion of this matter, and this court should affirm based on the direct evidence in this case.
What about the district court finding that Blevins, he's got the three people that are around or near him, and he testified that he was fearful for his safety, and the judge did find that testimony to be credible. How do we measure that in terms of our analysis?
Sure. So that is that regards the subjective element of self-defense, which is does appellant have a genuine and a reasonable fear for his safety. And because the district court did find that, this court has to defer to that as well. However, self-defense has several elements. The state only needs to disprove one. The element that the state disproved, that the district court found that the state disproved, was the objective element of retreat. And so I am dealt with what the district court order says. I disagree with that finding, but I'm not going to argue that to this court. I'm not the appellant.
So it did seem to me that this case turned on to retreat. It seemed like there was briefing on all of the elements, but I wonder whether that was even necessary. Is that under the theory that there's some ambiguity about some of the elements? I mean, the district court seemed to find it based on, find no self-defense based on only a single one. The other one seemed to favor.
Yep. Sure.
Is that right?
For the sake of completeness, I also included, I think both parties included analysis of whether the degree of force used was reasonable, mm-hmm. and I think it's important to note that the district court didn't reach that. It's almost as if the district court stopped at retreat and didn't continue on with the analysis about the reasonableness of the degree of force used. And so from respondent's perspective, appellant loses on degree of force used and also the duty to retreat because it was reasonably possible to retreat. Based on the direct evidence of the video, Mr. Blevins, the appellant, could retreat but did not. And it's important to note that the way appellant has been framing retreat in this case is retreat required appellant to turn his back or to retreat in a particular way. And that's not, there is no requirement that the duty to retreat is only possible if the person could turn around. I don't know any basis in law or fact for that, and I do want to note that appellant did retreat. He retreated by train. He could have retreated backing away, walking on foot. There were several instances where all three were retreating. In fact, appellant had pressed them all the way northbound on the platform, and then because he continued to wield his machete, JT did step in. But it is important to note that retreat is reasonably possible in this case in several different forms, on foot, calling the police, hopping on the train, which eventually he did do. So there were several avenues. And I understand appellant this morning at argument saying that it's unreasonable to call the police in this instance. However, those words and that avenue of retreat or seeking assistance came directly from appellant's mouth at trial. He said that JT should have called the police if he was so scared. And so appellant himself is saying that is also an option to avoid peril, avoid conflict, is to use the emergency blue phone at the station because that is what he himself said JT should have done in that instance. So there are several avenues of retreat. He chose none of them.
I think one of the arguments that I heard is that we should be looking at the tape only starting at 12:50 because that's when MBS, I think the argument was, brandished the knife. That's when And so after that point, there was not another train that came. There was, until the one he eventually got on, but there wasn't a way of retreating on the train. That, in other words, you know, any sort of, I mean, FTT, and he had sort of a verbal issue going, but then when MBS comes with a knife, that's when they're, he starts to fear for his life, right? And then it's at that point that we should look at the opportunities to retreat, and I think the argument was there wasn't a train, and that no point after that did all three of them back away.
I would have to, again, rewatch the video second by second to determine, but what I think Your Honor is saying is that, I just want to clarify, according to my brief, at 12:31 to 12:37, MBS approaches FTT and appellant. MBS has a large knife. So that is at 12:31, and that is exactly when the train arrives, the initial train in this sequence. So I see. In terms of the doors opening, the closing, the train is obviously still there, and people are embarking, disembarking, but it's the state's position that appellant could have gotten on that train, because if MBS got off the train or was nearby at the same time the train was entering, people were embarking, disembarking, that was an opportunity for him to retreat. And again, it's important to note he did ultimately retreat, but only after he seriously injured somebody with his machete after waving it around. In addition, I want to quickly address the question of precedential or unprecedented opinion in this case. There is no need to issue a precedential opinion in this case. This case is like State versus Richardson, which is another unprecedented opinion cited in respondent's brief. This almost identical facts, except this particular platform was in St. Paul. It's this one right over here, the Capitol Rice Street platform. This particular incident happened at night. It was two individuals standing on the light rail, one defendant walking past them, and then something happened such that the two men on the platform may or may not have antagonized the defendant that had walked past, and something occurred verbally such that that defendant did a 180, came back to them, and started a fight, ultimately using a razor blade to slash one of the men's faces. So in that case, I think it was charged as substantial bodily harm, so a different subdivision of the same assault, too. But in that case.
So talk to us about, I think that we're talking about precedential versus non-precedential more in light of whether there's a duty to retreat when there's non-physical force, so an assault fear case like this. Can you speak to the argument that there should be no such duty in a case like this where there is no physical force?
There should be no carve-out, because since 1865, this court has said that no matter the circumstances, the legal duty to retreat does exist. So I don't know what has changed between 1865 and now that would require such a carve-out. And I'll note that, again, in State versus Richardson, an unprecedented opinion, the duty to retreat was still required, even though there was just verbal antagonizing, and which ultimately ended up in the use of a sharp, dangerous weapon. But there is no need to revisit that. There is no need to carve out. First, because this is an error-correcting court, you apply the best law that is available to you, and the best law available to this court is the precedential opinions from the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court that said the duty is always there, and there is no carve-out for a non-deadly demonstration of a particular weapon. And there are policy reasons behind that I can address, Your Honor. I did address them in my brief as well. But an underlying tension here that is presented by appellant is you have the sort of right to protect yourself, the right to self-defense, and so balancing that with also the right to not be embarrassed. That's what Lefebvre comments on as well in his treatise. And there simply is, you want to also balance that with not having an arms race in the street every day, which I think is what, Judge Smith, you were referring to. So a fist fight, a knife is entered, a bigger machete is entered, a gun is entered, a nuclear bomb, those types of escalations. We want to deter those. So that is a main reason why we have all these limits on self-defense. And again, Lefebvre mentions that, I forgot the exact line, it is cited in my brief, but essentially embarrassment, so being called out, in this case appellant being told by FTT, you're not tough or something like that, which again, this court does not need to refer to that finding because there was no finding made regarding what FTT may or may not have said about that. But essentially my point is, if FTT is saying you're not tough, an appellant turns around, grabs at his machete, ultimately pulls it out, whips it around at all these people, there's a child nearby, that is the arms race that needs to be deterred by all of these requirements to be found not guilty under self-defense. So Mr. Blevins is not entitled to self-defense in this case, precisely because we want to avoid the arms race on public streets.
May I ask you a question about the speedy trial issue? On page 40 of your brief, tell me how this works and what you're arguing. On page 40 of your brief, you talk about Rule 11, and you say, of the Rules of Criminal Procedure, 11.09, at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And you say, under the rules, the district court was required to find good cause to continue the matter. Instead, the district court found extraordinary circumstances existed to continue the matter. And then you go on to conclude, appellant's speedy trial right was not violated under these rules. And even if we were to apply the four-factor test, and we must find, can you put together for me, are you saying that the issue can be decided only on the basis of the rule? What are you saying there, and that we wouldn't have to get to the constitutional four-part test?
Yes, my apologies for sort of a murky area of that brief. I simply was trying to point out that the district court did find good cause to continue the matter. And in fact, instead of saying good cause, use the extraordinary circumstances level. And if this court does entertain this argument and go through the Strobel factors, that even then,
Is there some reason we don't have to go through Strobel factors if it was more than a 60-day delay?
Can you say that again, Your
Honor? Is there some reason we don't have to get to the Strobel factors? What stops us from having to go there if that's the claim, that it violates the constitutional...
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay. I don't know of any where you don't get beyond the good cause argument. I think I was just trying to lay it out as clearly as possible, considering this was a pro se supplemental brief. And one other clarification I should make is, although I mentioned that good cause is a standard and the district court did say exigent circumstances or emergent circumstances, I forget the language, in the district court's verdict and order, I apologize, I'm out of town. If I could just
Please go ahead and finish your thought.
In the district court's verdict, it does say that on September 2nd, the district court found good cause based on the illness of JT. And then because the illness continued, the good cause continued. So thank you for letting me clarify. Should affirm.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Martin, you have the last word.
Thank you. I'd like to address a couple points. First of all, the state has argued that the duty to retreat doesn't include a duty to retreat safely. I would point to two things. First of all, the Devins case, the Minnesota Supreme Court did include the word safe in the duty to retreat, but also it's certainly part of the reasonableness requirement. We cannot expect people to retreat if it is not safe to do so. It is not reasonable in this case to expect Mr. Blevins to flee the three aggressors, given the circumstances of the case. I'm not suggesting that there is never going to be the ability to retreat on a light rail platform. But under the circumstances of this case, where there are the three aggressors in front of him, we can't expect him to back up. There's no way to back up safely under these circumstances. And it's not reasonable to expect him to take his eyes off someone who has just threatened him with a knife and threatened to slit his throat and the other two aggressors that are there. It's not reasonable under the circumstances, in part because a reasonable person who has just been threatened with their life and was still being confronted by three people would be very fearful, would be experiencing a tremendous amount of terror at that point. And it is not reasonable to expect them to pause and look around and assess all of the possible escape options. In this case, it is clear from the video that there was one escape option, and that was behind him. And he could not safely use that option without turning his back on the three people. Mr. Blevins was threatened by a group of three aggressors. He could not safely retreat. He resorted only to non-physical force, and he asks this court to reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today. The arguments were very helpful, and as I indicated before, a decision will be issued in the timely statutory timeframe of 90 days. Thank you.